Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Today's conference is being recorded. If there are any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I'd now like to introduce your host, Mr. George Friedman. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you, and thank you to the approximately 1,700 arbitrators who signed up for this next in a series of quarterly arbitrator call-ins. On behalf of my colleague, Linda Feinberg, and I, and the rest of the staff of FINRA Dispute Resolution, we thank you for participating. Today's call will cover two major topics. First, Linda Feinberg will cover recent rules and activities of interest to arbitrators, and also case filing trends, another topic of interest to arbitrators. Then, two of my colleagues from FINRA's Office of the General Counsel, who I'll introduce later, will participate in a panel discussion on topics of interest to arbitrators, specifically the following: electronic discovery, how to avoid being named in a lawsuit, and then what to do if you are named. In short, they'll cover the do's, the don'ts, and best practices for arbitrators serving in FINRA's Dispute Resolution Forum. Now, as always, an audio recording of this workshop, and by the way, previous workshops, can be found on FINRA's website. The address, and we'll repeat this a few times throughout the call, is www.finra.org, and just click on Resources for Neutrals. Okay. First, Linda Feinberg, President of FINRA Dispute Resolution, will discuss some rules in the pipeline, case filing trends, and other things we think might be of interest to you as arbitrators. Linda?
Thank you, George. To all of you listening in, we promise you no fire engines today. We have moved our venue to what we have been told is a soundproof room. We'll see. You'll recall at our November workshop, we discussed in detail our proposed dispositive motion rule. You may recall that rule, if approved, will severely limit the ability of parties to file motions to dismiss before a claimant has completed his or her case in chief. Similar proposals are outstanding with respect to the eligibility rule. I just wanted to bring you up to date on the status of those two rules, that is, the dispositive motion rule and the amendments to the eligibility rule. We have filed those proposals with the Securities and Exchange Commission. We have made some editorial changes at the request of the SEC staff, and we anticipate that it will be published imminently for comment. Which is the next step. The SEC will put it in the Federal Register, ask for comments. You, as well as anyone else who has an interest in the forum, is free to file a comment with the SEC, at which point we will review all of the comments and take further action. I would urge you, in the interim, as we have done on our website and in our phone conversations, to look very carefully when motions to dismiss are filed to make sure that you don't burden parties with responses if you can determine on the face of the papers that the motion would not be granted. At our last call, you might recall that George mentioned that we were in the process of putting together new procedures for expungements of information from a registered person's CRD record. I'm happy to say that we have now completed the initial stages of that process. After board approval, we have drafted a rule filing, which we anticipate filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission today. It should be on our website either tomorrow or on Monday. And the purpose of the proposal is to ensure that an expungement occurs only when the arbitrators find and document one of the narrow grounds specified in Rule 2130 for granting an expungement. As you all know, those grounds are that the claim is factually impossible or clearly erroneous, that the registered person was not involved in the alleged misconduct, or that the claim, allegation, or information is false. Those are the current provisions of Rule 2130, as well as the fact that if granted an expungement, a registered rep must at that point have the award confirmed in court. that if the SEC approves the proposed rule that we will be filing this week, the rule will require that arbitrators, in considering an expungement, must do the following four things before awarding an expungement. First, review settlement documents and consider the amounts paid to any party and any other conditions of the settlement that might raise concerns about the associated person's involvement in the alleged misconduct. In other words, what we'd like to avoid in the public interest is the so-called buying of an expungement. It's really important that expungements be granted only when one of the three narrow grounds for granting an expungement is found. Second, it will be required that a recorded hearing be held, and that hearing can either be by telephone or in person, and that hearing must take place before an expungement can be awarded. This will come up mostly in the settlement context, because, of course, if there's a merits hearing, there will, by virtue of that, have been a hearing. But when arbitrators are asked to consider stipulated awards that have an expungement in them, it will now be required that they conduct a hearing, either in person or by phone. Third, we will be asking arbitrators to provide a brief written explanation of the reason for ordering the expungement. It will not be sufficient just to cite one of the three prongs of Rule 2130. And finally, the rule would require that all forum fees for the hearing session in which the determination of whether an expungement is appropriate is the only topic for the hearing, that those fees be assessed against the party requesting expungement. Now, once this is filed with the SEC, you'll have the opportunity to review the proposal on our website and, of course, to comment as well. Thirdly, and many of you had this happen to you, you've signed off on a case, the award's been issued, 3 years go by, and one of the parties asks to have the hearing open. We have determined that it would be appropriate to file a rule with the SEC that will greatly limit the circumstances when a case that has been closed would be submitted to the arbitrators. And those are limited to the following circumstances. When a court orders a case to be reopened, at the request of any party within 30 days of the service of an award that a matter has been closed, or notice that a matter has been closed, for ministerial matters, or if all the parties agree to submit documents within 30 days of service of an award or notice that a matter has been closed. And we think that that will greatly aid you as arbitrators, but also parties who often are put to great expense in responding to such a request. Now on to something else dear to many of you. We've gotten a number of requests from arbitrators as to why they haven't been called to serve in a number of years. As you all know, after reaching a high of almost 9,000 claims filed in 2003 and the attendant hearings in 2004 and 2005, we were all very busy through 2005. The last number of years, starting in 2004, has seen a great diminution of the number of claims filed. And that's the reason many of you have not been called upon to serve. In addition, of course, as you know, 80% of the claims filed do not go to hearing. Rather, they are settled before a hearing takes place. In the last 2 months, the trend has begun to reverse, and we are now seeing an increase in the number of claims filed. And two particular areas of interest, we have had almost 100 claims filed concerning subprime mortgages, particularly when the debt instruments are sold in funds, mutual funds, and the allegations tend to be that there was inadequate disclosure about the nature of the debt being that is in the mutual fund portfolio. The second relates to auction notes. I'm sure you've all been reading about those in the paper. So we do expect that the cases will greatly increase over the next 2 years, and that more of you will be placed on lists and asked to serve as arbitrators. And with that, I'll now turn it back to George.
Thanks, Linda. We'll now move to the discussion of do's and don'ts for arbitrators. Now, those of you who participated in the last call will remember we did an online survey shortly after the call, and we asked you what we could do better, what we should stop doing, like moving away from sirens, for example. And one of the comments that we heard consistently was that arbitrators and mediators like to hear from staff or others involved in real life in dealing with issues that are, that they might face. And so for today's call, we've asked two of our colleagues from the FINRA Office of General Counsel to help us address the following issues. The first is electronic discovery, or as one of our guests here today says, what Silicon Valley did for all of us. The second is the neutral as defendant. That gets to a question that came from one of the arbitrators, which is, what is a neutral? Of course, a neutral was the response. And we have to avoid lapsing into jargon, but in FINRA dispute resolution jargon, a neutral is an arbitrator or a mediator. Whether the arbitrator is public or non-public, we assume all FINRA arbitrators, mediators, and arbitrators, whether public or non-public, and mediators are neutral. So that's our term. So again, the second topic is neutrals as defendants, and things you can do to stay away from trouble, and things that you do that will get you into trouble. More on that later. And then the third is defending neutrals. What happens, if a neutral becomes involved in litigation or other administrative actions arising out of the case? To help us deal with these questions are my two esteemed colleagues, John Flood. John is Vice President and Associate General Counsel of FINRA's Office of the General Counsel, and Sarah Gill, Senior Attorney. These are the folks we call when we get into trouble or you get into trouble. So what they have to say to us today we think is very important. For those who like to take compulsive notes, I think you might put your pens down or at least not take as many notes, because within a week or so after our call today, we'll be sending out a really well-defined and detailed PowerPoint that will cover everything that we're going to be covering today and probably more. And again, that'll be sent to anyone who registered for this call within the next week or so. All right, let's jump right into the first topic then, electronic discovery. I should mention, before I pose the first question, there was an excellent article in the Neutral Corner, the issue before the current one, written by Rachel Glasgow. She works in the FINRA Dispute Resolution Northeast Office. So I encourage our arbitrators and mediators listening in to go online to our webpage and download that issue. It goes into quite a bit of detail on e-discovery. And the current issue of the Neutral Corner that came out just a couple of days ago goes into a nice discussion about discovery issues in general and also how to deal with subpoenas. And I thank Jasuk Lee, the editor, for putting that together, and I encourage you all to check on that. All right, first question, John. What is e-discovery? What is electronic discovery, and why do we care about it?
Well, George, until about 200 years ago, much of mankind was functionally illiterate. There really weren't that many written words. There certainly weren't electronic images. Stories that were important to men and women in those times were conveyed through cave paintings, or perhaps paintings atop the Sistine Chapel, or even stained glass windows. Not because the messages were pretty, but because that was the way you could communicate with people who could not read or write. And so all you had to do was destroy the bricks, the mortar, block up the caves, and perhaps you could prevent those images from lasting until today. Now it's quite a bit different. Anyone who's read the instant messages or emails that appear in the newspapers today, or which you may see from your children or grandchildren or perhaps even your spouses, are written in a very casual language. So casual, in fact, that you might think that mankind remains functionally illiterate. But they convey messages, and people communicate electronically in a different method than they communicate, for those of us who are older, in old-fashioned hard copy memos. And so it takes on added importance for that reason. But also, I, for instance, receive approximately 32,500 emails in the course of a year. some of which I actually read and respond to. But the emails exist not just on the electronic server of the person who sent the message, they also exist on the server of the person who received the message. And if I forward that message to Sarah and George and Linda, they might exist on multiple servers, and that would multiply. So the chance of actually erasing a message, of eliminating an email or a communication, has largely disappeared from society. Many of you will remember over the last 10 or 15 years, the Microsoft trial, where the master of the universe of the electronic world, was hoisted on his own petard by his own emails, which led to a very significant and adverse ruling. You'll remember the Arthur Anderson case, in which memoranda and emails written by even the inside counsel dealt with document retention and destruction policies, which led to a criminal prosecution that was ultimately overturned. Modern-day Senate confirmation hearings, which are familiar to those of us here in Washington, often turn on memos that were written by junior White House staffers 20 or 25 years ago in Reagan or Carter administrations or elsewhere. And so people find themselves not talking about today's events, but about things from a long time ago. So the electronic discovery world is very much like, if I could borrow a phrase, the Roach Motel communication. Emails go in, but they never go out. They don't disappear. And so that's why electronic discovery is important, because as society has changed the way that we communicate with each other and the frequency, the method by which these are preserved means that more and more of the cases which the neutrals will be resolving, whether as an arbitrator or as a mediator, will involve the review of hopefully carefully dissected and presented summaries of email communications, memoranda, maybe the Facebook pages that people have put out describing themselves, or it may even be the emails that show that a particular investor was not just following an investment pattern pursuant to the recommendation of one broker, but may have been doing that in four or five different accounts. Or, on the opposite side of that, the broker might have been advising not just one customer, but every one of his customers to do exactly the same thing. And so, that is both the burden and the opportunity of electronic discovery.
That sounds like paper discovery. Sarah, is it different? Any differences between what John just described and the paper discovery we all know so well?
George, it is different. And the main difference, and the most significant difference really, is the volume. Because, as John was saying, electronic documents are often preserved in multiple places and for a long, long time, they are usually available for discovery. And the volume is huge because if a discovery request seeks emails pertaining to a certain trade from a broker, for example, how do you find those emails? Well, often a search function is not reliable enough. You may have someone like Don with 32,000 emails for the year, and you may have to review 32,000 emails to find the perhaps 100 emails that are actually responsive to the discovery request. And that's why the cost factor is so much greater here than with paper discovery, where you have many fewer documents. Another significant aspect with electronic discovery is that you can get documents in different formats. So they're not really documents anymore. Now we're talking about electronic records. For example, if someone is asking for documents about a trade that were created in Word, Microsoft Word, you could provide those documents as a PDF. And for those of you who aren't familiar with that, that is basically a photocopy of the document, but it's an electronic photocopy. So it doesn't have what's called metadata, and I'll get into that shortly. But you could also provide the document as a Word document. And then the document will have the metadata that underlies the document. So those are very significant because you get much more information when you get the document as the Word document with the metadata.
Okay, you know my next question then. So what is metadata?
Absolutely. Well, metadata is, as you've probably seen from articles and so forth, focusing on discovery, metadata is a huge issue these days. Metadata is data about data. And there are two types of metadata. First, you have file system data. And that's the type of metadata that if you have some computer expertise, you can get onto your computer and see it yourself. And when you get the PowerPoint that we have for this presentation, you'll see some examples that show file system metadata.
So we'll take the metadata out of the PowerPoint, I assume.
We will absolutely take the metadata out of the PowerPoint. So the file system data shows you information such as who wrote the document, when did they write the document, when did they last make changes to the document, what did they actually call the document in their electronic folder, what did they call the folder that the document was placed in. And this often doesn't matter at all. But it could matter because you might have a witness testify that she knows nothing about a certain trade. Well, then you might have a Word document that talks about the trade. And if you check the metadata, you see that she is the author of the document. Hmm. So all of a sudden, there's proof that she knew about the trade. So that's one way where metadata is important. The other type of metadata is a bit more complicated. It is called embedded data, and you need a forensic person to find it quite often. But basically, if you're in a Word document, all the edits that you make to it, the different people who review it and comment on it, well, you think that that information is gone from the document because it doesn't print out. You can't see it on your screen. Well, a forensic expert can actually retrieve that. So, if you produce your Word documents as Word documents, and what that is called is in their native format, all of this underlying information could become available.
Yeah. I remember back in my law school days studying the federal rules of civil procedure and evidence, and I can assure you, without saying how long ago it was, there was nothing about e-discovery in those rules and guides. Has that changed, John?
It has, George, and unlike you, I actually, I studied for the bar in New York. I think we were still using the field code from 1870. But if you look at the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure today, the rules have been amended in December 1st of 2006 to try to address electronic discovery. In many ways, electronic discovery is old wine in new bottles, that the principles that apply to it are largely the same as apply to other topics in discovery. And yet, as we'll make clear throughout the presentation, there are key differences. Congress acted at the behest of the Judicial Conference, the Executive Office of the United States Court. Judges had been grappling with electronic discovery issues long before these rules were adopted. Trial lawyers were dealing with these issues, both on the plaintiff's side and the defendant's side. And so there was some pressure for Congress to put some common sense rules together. And probably most fundamental to the rules is the admonition that the parties and the triers of fact in our world, the neutrals, need to address these issues early on, to start the dialogue early, because electronic discovery can take a great deal more time to perform. It can be very, very costly, which, when you think about it, may provide an opportunity for mediators to point this out to the parties that are before them, that if they want to pursue a case to its ultimate end, it may actually cost more to do the electronic discovery than the amount that's being fought over. So perhaps there can be a positive side to electronic discovery, but for the most part, the poor associates at law firms and other people spend an awful lot of time reading many thousands of emails and also electronic forms of memoranda that wouldn't have been available 20 years ago.
Okay, now, before when I defined neutrals, I said arbitrators and mediators. They're not judges. So why, you know, why would this, I mean, I don't mean to be cute about it, but why would this be of interest to arbitrators or mediators when in fact, you know, these are rules that judges typically apply?
Well, in many ways, if you think of whether you're thinking about arbitrators or mediators, at the very core, they are the coordinators of the dispute resolution process. And so they have an opportunity to bring up these issues early, and I would suggest to our audience that it's probably appropriate to bring it up at the initial pre-hearing conference stage to get the parties, to point them in the right direction to start discussing it with each other, what they have to do to fulfill their obligations to preserve documents, but also to do a search of the information in their own possession, because our guidelines on discovery provide that certain types of documents have to be exchanged between the parties. Increasingly, the SEC has approved the keeping of documents solely in electronic format as satisfying a record-keeping obligation that broker-dealers have.
I think it's a good takeaway, by the way, for the arbitrators listening to the call today. You know, we do it in the FINRA discovery guidelines. Lots of references to documents, and the important takeaway is it doesn't necessarily limit it to paper documents. I think at this point we're in a realm now where documents can be electronic, and that's an important thing for arbitrators to remember, I think. All right, a couple more questions. We'll move to the next topic. Let's move to guidance on handling subpoenas. Now, there was just to remind arbitrators, there was a rule change effective in January of 2007 that essentially says subpoenas in connection with FINRA dispute resolution arbitrations get issued only by arbitrators, whether they're subpoenas for document production, discovery, or for people or documents to actually come to a hearing. Only arbitrators issue such subpoenas. So these issues increasingly come to arbitrators, naturally. And you know, just to start, what kind of advice? My guess is there'll be increasingly an increasing number of subpoenas dealing with e-discovery. And what advice, John, would you give arbitrators in terms of how to deal with that?
Well, there are three points I'd like to share, and I'm sure that Sarah has others. But first of all, you want to apply your common sense, because ultimately, the resolution of discovery disputes, like the resolution of the total dispute itself, involve common sense assessment and the application of reason. First, if you were the claimant in a case, what documents, electronic or otherwise, would you want to have access and be able to see? So first, look at it through the prism of the claimant's perspective. And secondly, look at it through the prism of the respondent's perspective or even a third party that gets a request for electronic discovery. What would you have to do to comply with the request that you're being asked to sign in a subpoena? And is it reasonable to expect parties and third parties who are not before you to have to go to those efforts to produce the documents that, if you were a claimant, you wanted to see? And thirdly, many times, as Sarah alluded to earlier, you're talking about massive amounts of data, and the parties may be looking for a needle in a haystack or a smoking gun. But not every haystack has a needle. And so electronic discovery can perhaps be even more frustrating than traditional forms of discovery. Sarah, do you have some other points to share?
I do. Sometimes we've seen subpoenas where parties are requesting, for example, all examination files for a firm. And the people writing the subpoenas perhaps don't realize that that can be hundreds and hundreds of examinations. And each examination could have many boxes of documents. And frankly, that's probably not going to be helpful to receive hundreds of boxes. No one wants that many documents to go through to find that one document they're really looking for. So it's really important to make sure that the parties requesting the subpoenas have narrowed the scope of their discovery request as much as possible.
And that would be a good question, I guess, if these disputes bubble up to arbitrators about the breadth of a request or the time limit for responding. A good question for an arbitrator would be, can we narrow this to something a little less broad than what's before?
Absolutely. And to think of all the ways one can narrow by date, by the person who would have the documents, by the type of documents, and also to specify, are we looking for emails, calendars, general documents, and there are many other ways as well. But it's important to be creative.
And it's also one thing, some people have very good document management habits. They might create what is called a personal folder. And in the brokerage world, that may be broken down by customer name or identity. And so if you can capture and the parties can quickly produce a personal folder or PST file, as it might more technically be called, you may very well, in the case of someone who's organized, have a very good, quick sample, which may approach the totality of the universe of documents that may be responsive. And so there's that type of reasonable approach that can be taken. But in terms of trying to set up deadlines, realize that electronic discovery can take longer. You may want to set up an initial deadline of, say, 30 to 45 days for the parties to go out to do this, their search of their documents or in responding to a subpoena. And if a party comes back to you and talks about the burden or the expense, you'll have another opportunity to reassess what is appropriate in that matter. Complex matters, obviously, would take a great deal longer than 30 to 45 days.
And I'll just add that the deadline should be from the time of service, because sometimes it takes a while for the party to actually get served with the subpoena.
And some people would hold service intentionally.
All right, now on to the next topic, a little less pleasant, perhaps, but avoiding being named in a lawsuit. You know, John, you've been with the company for many, many years, so let's start with some easy stuff. What should arbitrators do to keep themselves out of trouble? Or let me say it positively, do you have any best practices to articulate for the arbitrators and mediators listening in today?
Absolutely. On a negative point, you have to realize that sometimes, no matter what you do, an arbitrator or other neutral will be named in a lawsuit regardless of the propriety or impropriety of any decision that they have reached. And it could be simply the lawyers feel that they need to name the arbitrators as a party because that's who they're appearing in front of, rather than just naming the forum itself. But on a positive note, try to disclose everything you can to the parties, and then some, about your professional relationships to the parties, to the arbitrators, to counsel, regarding your personal, physical, or mental health, if that might be relevant during the course of an extended hearing, but also even something as simply as what country clubs, temples, other associations you might belong to, because you don't know everybody who might be a witness in the proceeding. The lawyers, hopefully, would be better informed than the neutrals about what may develop during the case. So the more you tell them up front, the less likely you are to be criticized down the road for having withheld something. But of course, it's up to the parties and counsel to tell you the relevant people involved. No one in the hearing room knows how wonderful a person you are. During the course of the hearing, whether in person or by telephone, show them how wonderful you are by your patience, by your understanding, and your compassion. Because understand, it isn't always just a business dispute. It may have a lot of emotional content for the people in front of you. Try to stay on the record at all times. There are very few good reasons why you would stop the recording devices. When I was a young lawyer, Justice Malonis, who went on to the highest courts in New York, told people not to approach the bench, not to say things off the record, because if it couldn't be said on the record, he didn't want to hear it. And that's 31 years into practicing law, I appreciate the wisdom far more than I did at that time. No matter how heated the parties or their counsel may get in front of you, never lose your cool or your composure, because you will lose control of the proceeding. Let the lawyers do the lawyering. Don't do your own research. Let them present their cases. If there's something you need research on, ask them to brief the issue. And when the case is over, or either when the hearings are over, try to rule promptly and completely, making sure you've addressed everything that was put before you for adjudication. And lastly, once the award has issued, follow the code of omerta that you hear about in movies. Don't discuss awards once they've been issued, because if you do, it can only lead to bad consequences.
At one point, I'll make the PowerPoint that we'll be sending in a week or so has several case citations and also references to the Code of Ethics for Arbitrators, which does apply to any arbitrator serving in our forum. So I would encourage arbitrators to look at those. There's one case in particular, John, when you were mentioning disclosure, there was a Supreme Court case, 1967-68, called Commonwealth Codings, and it said it's not so much the disclosure but the failure to disclose that raises an inference of bias. And another point I'd like to get across is just because an arbitrator has to disclose something doesn't mean the arbitrator is going to be removed from the case. So the threshold for disclosure is fairly low, and again, we underscore that arbitrators should disclose. Well, I have a feeling your list, John, Sarah, was developed from real-life examples, but any real-life examples you'd like to share with those listening in today?
Yes, we won't go into war stories, but just some examples of things that can be problematic. Blank tapes, or gaps in tapes, allow people to speculate about what took place. Gary Weiss wrote a book about one FINRA arbitration, and the case made its way up all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And it was largely because some of the then tapes that were being used were blank, either through inadvertence or error, or maybe the machine didn't work. Gaps in tapes may have been okay for Rosemary Woods 30 years ago during Watergate, for those of us old enough to remember that. But it didn't help President Nixon. Secondly, you know, country club relationships. And for those of you who may belong to a country club in a less urban area, you may be very close or have golfing buddies or tennis buddies, and it's natural that they may want to discuss with you the things that you do. And it could be that months before, you had been an arbitrator in a case with this perhaps casual acquaintance. Realize this, that when one arbitrator, after an award is issued, when only one arbitrator talks about a case, probably all three arbitrators will end up testifying about it. So that's why, as a practical matter, be polite, but be silent. Because in the end, you've spoken through the award, and there should be no other effort to do it. And after an award's issued, there are some people, some counsel, who may call you up. And they may be claimant's counsel, they may be respondent's counsel. It does not matter who. There's no reason for you to be discussing the case. They may employ a subterfuge to say, well, you know, if you'll just talk to me about this for a few minutes, I won't need to depose you. That's the surest shortcut to ending up as a guest for hours of deposition. Better to say nothing. And here's a third one that you may not, I hope no one's offended by this, but it's very important to the arbitrators to dress appropriately. Use the power clothing of your authority. People, you know, coming into a room wearing a plaid shirt may not work so well. You want to maintain the control and maintain composure, and suitable clothing is one way. Oftentimes, we have this problem with some counsel. People may wear things that are appropriate for an evening function, but are inappropriate in a hearing room. So use your common sense in this regard as well, and you're less likely to have problems.
Right now, Sarah, you're one of the people I call, and we have difficult calls from arbitrators about cases. Sometimes even before a case is served, arbitrators are named, and sometimes after a case is concluded, perhaps because they didn't listen to John's advice to remain silent. So you know, what are the kind of things that get arbitrators enmeshed in litigations arising out of an arbitration?
Well, there are a lot of things, unfortunately. And let me introduce the answer by pointing out why so many things can get arbitrators enmeshed in litigation. The first reason is a lot of people sue arbitrators thinking that that's what they're supposed to do, but they're not. For example, you might have people who sue arbitrators for their motion to vacate an arbitration award.
And they think they have to.
They think they have to. And that's just simply a mistake by their counsel, or perhaps the person is pro se without counsel. So that's one reason arbitrators get sued, by a mistake. There really are no good reasons to sue arbitrators because of immunity.
Or FINRA, I should point out. I know John wanted me to say that.
Absolutely. So even if an arbitrator does everything right, an arbitrator might get sued. Before the lawsuit or at the beginning of the lawsuit, people sue an arbitrator sometimes to move a case to a different forum. For example, to a court as opposed to arbitration. They might sue an arbitrator to try to disqualify the arbitrator, to delay or expedite a hearing. Now, after the award is issued, and that's, we probably see more cases dealing with that are filed after the award is issued. And unfortunately, again, sometimes that just happens because the person is unhappy with the outcome of their case. So that's something that may sound almost sarcastic, but it's reality.
And related to lawsuits, does it also occur that arbitrators are, when they're dragged in, not as parties, but to be subpoenaed to describe what happened in the arbitration or to explain the award?
Absolutely. And people have been subpoenaed to explain awards. And again, that's just wrong, because arbitrators have testimonial immunity and are not allowed to discuss their awards by the Code of Ethics. And legally, they are not required to discuss their awards. So people don't know that. So they try to sue an arbitrator to get a discussion of an award.
But Sarah, is arbitral immunity different from testimonial immunity? You just introduced a phrase that I think perhaps a lot of people are not aware of.
That actually gets us to our next topic, which is what to do. One quick question. I don't want to scare our arbitrators immediately. I mean, how often is it that arbitrators are actually sued? I mean,
to just kind of put a percentage on it so that everyone can appreciate it, out of the total number of thousands of cases that are filed a year, probably 1% or less of all cases involve a trip to the courthouse for the forum or for the parties or for the neutrals who are serving in this function. So it is rare.
Good. Well, let's get to Linda's question. Okay, despite the fact that it's rare and it shouldn't happen, suppose it does. So, Sarah, if an arbitrator is named, I'm going to define that in a second, or enmeshed, excuse my term. You know, what should they do? And I mean enmeshed. There are three broad categories. One is they're named as a defendant. They get papers. The other is they're subpoenaed in connection with the arbitration. Either to impeach the award or perhaps there's an action against an attorney for malpractice, but somehow enmeshed, they get a subpoena. And the third is something like a bar complaint, a really angry party that will file a bar or professional complaint. So when I say papers, I mean any of the above.
Right.
And so what should arbitrators do when that happens?
Well, arbitrators should call us right away if they are sued, because we represent you. Arbitrators and mediators, we represent you if you are sued due to your work for us. And the number you should call our Office of General Counsel, and the main number for Office of General Counsel is, and this will be in the PowerPoint, but I'm giving it to you now as well, it's 202-728-8294. And when you call, ask to speak with a litigation attorney. That's very important. You want to speak with one of the litigation attorneys.
It's important that you call our Office of General Counsel rather than your case administrator or case assistant. Talking with our lawyers will protect those conversations, and that might become important in the course of the proceeding.
Now we keep talking about suits against arbitrators. Now, Linda just used the term immunity. I thought arbitrators and media were immune from liability. So why are we talking about this?
Well, absolutely. Arbitrators and mediators are immune from liability. And to answer Linda's earlier question, testimonial immunity derives from arbitral immunity.
Perhaps you could explain that to us.
Arbitrators, like judges, are independent decision makers. to preserve the independence of this process, they are immune from civil liability for actions that are within the scope of their arbitral duties. So as long as you are acting, and this applies to mediators as well. So as long as you, arbitrators and mediators, are acting within the scope of your duties as an arbitrator or mediator, then you are immune from liability. Now, one very important point here. Just because you are immune from liability, that does not mean you can ignore a lawsuit. And
repeat that, it's an important point.
And we're saying this because it happened. So, just because, now that you know that you are immune from liability, don't get excited about that. And if you get a complaint, if you receive a complaint where you are sued due to actions within the scope of your arbitral duties, don't throw it away saying, I'm immune, they can't sue me for this, I'm throwing it away. Don't do that, because you have been named in a lawsuit. And the only way to get rid of it is for us to represent you, file a motion to dismiss the lawsuit, and prevail.
And if you ignore it, a default judgment could be entered against you.
Absolutely.
And it's never happened, but it certainly has the potential to happen. We'd rather hear from you early and often than too late, because early on we could provide the greatest defense and we'll have the maximum time to prepare a defense to act to get the case dismissed. And I can say at this point that over the last 20 years that I've headed litigation here at FINRA and our other corporate names previously, to my knowledge, no arbitrator or mediator has ever had a judgment entered against him or her. FINRA and its neutrals have been represented by both experienced in-house counsel as well as national and regional law firms. While anyone can sue a neutral or anyone else here in the United States with or without good reason, the courts have been steadfast in extending judicial and testimonial immunity to arbitrators, mediators, and the arbitration and mediation forum. We're trying to help you here so that you understand that it is highly unlikely that you'll ever have a judgment to worry about, but no one likes being sued. It's not like receiving a bouquet of flowers. It can be a long and drawn-out process, but I will say that in most of our cases, the lawsuits go away in well under a year. So it's rare for something to drag on, and we'll be able to get rid of it because we know it's a bother to you, it's a bother to us, and we want to continue to encourage people to serve as neutrals. We provide the very best defense that we can. We see these cases often. And the law firms that we hire are names that you've heard of. And they have been universally successful in defending against these, not just lawsuits or subpoenas, but also bar complaints that some people, particularly in Florida and California, are more prone to file.
Do you ever seek sanctions for an attorney filing a what we would deem a frivolous action against an arbitrator?
We have, and we have received awards of sanctions, but usually by people who are judgment-proof to begin with. You can spend a lot of time trying to chase a sanction, but there are appropriate cases where you want to make that point and to discourage people from doing it in the future. A related point is that on your behalf, as well as FINRA's behalf, FINRA maintains significant and substantial insurance coverage for defending such matters. To my knowledge, and I've worked here at FINRA for 31 years, there has never been a case where an insurance company has had to make a payment on behalf of any FINRA neutral or on behalf of the forum, because the cases have universally been defeated.
Is the immunity, I'll ask either one of you, is the immunity complete, is it absolute, or I guess to move away from legal jargon, can arbitrators or mediators do something to jeopardize the immunity that they enjoy?
They can, George. The key to immunity is you have to be acting within the scope of your duties as an arbitrator or as a mediator. So if you deviate from that becomes a risky area, and we haven't had as far as I know, one of these cases. But an example could be, and this is a bit extreme, but just to make the point, during your arbitration, on a break, you punch one of the attorneys. That's an assault. That's not within the scope of your arbitral duties. So that you might not be covered by on the punch.
And in fact, we have had that case, and that case got settled. But the arbitrator did not have a judgment entered against him. That was a case that happened many years ago, and we made the business decision that it was better to resolve it. And the victim of that attack by someone else in the forum was a reasonable person, and the matter was resolved.
Now, in my understanding, the courts will give the arbitrators and mediators a pretty broad leeway in terms of saying the conduct that was related to their service as arbitrator or mediator. Any examples?
Absolutely. Some examples would be if an arbitrator is taping the hearing, or someone is taping the hearing, and it turns out that the tape failed. People have received immunity for that. People have also received immunity when they have lost evidence. People have received immunity for claims, again, we're not saying they're true, but claims of unfair arbitration. Also, people have received immunity, arbitrators have received immunity when they failed to disclose conflicts. And arbitrators receive immunity for allegations of negligence during the hearing.
And the courts have been consistent in such cases in saying that the sole remedy for a person aggrieved by that type of error or negligence or misjudgment is not a monetary judgment, but to vacate an award and have another arbitration.
Okay, last question, and then...
For those of you who are parties in the forum as well, the appropriate person on the other side of a case moving to vacate is not the arbitrator and not the forum, but the person who was on the other side in your arbitration case. So if you are claimant and you are moving to vacate an award, the appropriate other party in your court motion to vacate is the respondent in your arbitration. Again, neither the arbitrator nor the forum.
The one area where you get into where the forum is a necessary party is not in that example, Linda, but in instances under Rule 2130 where a party has requested expungement relief and where the panel has made a ruling with regards to that, and the party is required to either get FINRA to waive the requirement to be named in the lawsuit or they must name FINRA in the lawsuit so that the expungement order can be validated or confirmed by a court of competent jurisdiction, and so that then the expungement order can be effectuated.
John, Sarah, a very interesting discussion. Any parting thoughts or words of wisdom to those listening today?
Well, we'd like to thank all of our neutrals for your service. You provide a great service in helping investors in the securities industry.
And people take their duties very seriously, and we can see that with the tremendous amount of preparation and care that goes into the cases, but especially the disclosure statements. And one last thought, there's never a bad time to go back and increase your familiarity with the Code of Ethics for arbitrators, because much of the wisdom that you'll need in fulfilling your duties is contained in that Code of Ethics.
And you'll also find a lot of answers to your questions in FINRA's Code of Arbitration Procedures, in FINRA's Discovery Guide. We've listed a lot of resources at the back of the PowerPoint that you can go to for assistance. But also, if you have a question and you can't find the answer, call us. We're happy to help.
And my parting words of wisdom, if you get court papers in connection with the arbitration, when in doubt, don't throw it out. Sorry, I couldn't resist. We solicited questions from the arbitrators, and we've tried to, and mediators, we've tried to address all of them. There's one that came in sort of late, so I'm going to send it to Linda, which is, what is it, at the last call we mentioned the expansion of the Discovery Arbitrator Pilot Project, and one of the arbitrators emailed us and said, what's going on, where is it?
Well, we have, as you know, piloted the Discovery Arbitrator in our western and southeast regions. We are now expanding it in three ways. It will be available in all four of our regions. So we are expanding it to the Midwest and the Northeast regions. In addition, we have added to our Discovery Arbitrator roster industry arbitrators. And those arbitrators will be available in intra-industry cases where a panel would otherwise have three industry arbitrators. And we have determined to run the pilot for an added time through to the end of 2009. We are in the process now of selecting these additional arbitrators in the Northeast and the Midwest regions, and the added pilot availability should be up and running within the next two or three weeks.
Perfect. Okay, well, I think it's time to wrap up. A couple of reminders. First of all, I want to thank John and Sarah. Just terrific. And Linda and I thank you very much. It's really interesting. I'm sure we're going to get great feedback on today's call. A few reminders for the arbitrators out there. If you haven't done so, please, please take the revised Code of Arbitration training. It's online. It's free. Reminder that an audio file of today's call will be posted on FINRA's website fairly soon, a couple of days. Sometime within the next week, we will be forwarding to anyone who registered for this program the aforementioned PowerPoint. It's really excellent. I encourage you to look at it. Our next call, if you want to write this down, our next call to whet your appetites will be on June 19th. And in keeping with the comments we received from the online survey, the topic will be experienced neutrals present best practices for handling difficult situations. To do that, rather than staff telling you about that, we're bringing in two really experienced arbitrators who I've known both for about 30 years. Professor Constantine, or Gus as we call him, Katsouris from Fordham Law School, or the Dean of Arbitrators as many people refer to him. He's been an arbitrator for many, many years. And David Robbins, who's a partner at the Kaufman Spiner firm up in New York, longtime arbitrator. He serves on FINRA's National Arbitration and Mediation Committee, chairs, in fact, the Neutral Roster Subcommittee. So Gus and Dave will be coming in to visit with us and talk about real-life problems, the good, the bad, and the ugly, as Dave, I think, said. And we encourage you, and we will by encourage you by sending an email, encourage you to send questions in advance because they're looking forward to really addressing nuts and bolts issues that arbitrators face and more importantly, they have faced over their careers as arbitrators. Thanks for joining us. Enjoy the rest of the day, and thank you very much. Bye-bye.